And that was it. Shit, Collins thought. Here we are at this instant in history that shall forever be remembered, and it's just some guy saying, you are go for TLI. And yet, that was the way men who lived faster than sound communicated. Just enough to give direction, and then get out of the way. Roger, Borman replied. We understand. We are go for TLI. 20 minutes remained before the third stage engine would reignite and begin the translunar injection burn. At home in Houston, Susan Borman stayed attached to her squawk box. She wished for privacy at this moment. Instead, documentary filmmakers had their cameras trained on her, along with microphones placed around the house. Susan had protested the invasion, but Frank told her it was part of NASA's plan and couldn't be helped. Valerie Anders faced the same scrutiny before the cameras, but seemed less put off, at least for now. The astronauts spent the next several minutes making final checks, strapping back into their seats, and preparing for the translunar injection burn. They wouldn't need their helmets, since they didn't expect a breach in the cabin and a loss of pressure. About 90 seconds before the engine was to fire, a light came on in the command module, indicating the final countdown to ignition. In the Soviet Union, many in the space program still could not believe what was occurring. We could have done this first, one cosmonaut thought. Only the indecisiveness of our chief designer caused us to fall behind. Just 60 seconds remained, but the crew could still cancel the burn by throwing the inhibit switch if things didn't look right. At 18 seconds, they'd have no choice but to allow the engine to light. 18 seconds now remained. Kraft's heart pounded. He well remembered the second and most recent test flight of the Saturn V, when the third stage had flat out failed to restart. If that happened again, Apollo 8 would be fated to an orbit around Earth, and the lunar mission would have failed. 8 seconds before ignition, liquid hydrogen began to run through opened valves and to the engine as Borman counted down. 4, 3, 2. Liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen flooded into the engine's combustion chamber. An indicator in the cabin lighted up brightly, telling Borman and crew ignition was imminent. In Hawaii, hundreds of people gazed upward. All they could see was a pinpoint of light. Ignition, Lovell said. The J-2 engine fired, pushing the astronauts gently back into their seats. In Hawaii, observers saw the tiny point of light explode into a giant streak of flame, a man-made comet glowing bright across the dark veil of sky. This was the acceleration that would be necessary to extend the spacecraft's orbit out to where the moon would be in about 66 hours' time. At the moment, the moon was farther back in its orbit around Earth and nowhere near where Apollo 8 was pointing. But if everything went right, the moon, itself streaking through space at an average speed of 2,288 miles per hour, would arrive just in time to rendezvous with the little spacecraft. While the astronauts monitored systems and prepared to fly the vehicle manually in case the engine or steering system failed, Apollo 8 began to pitch up from its orientation parallel to Earth and climb higher away from its home. G-forces increased from 0.7 past 1.0 as Lovell watched the digits on the cabin's velocity indicator, which seemed to spin upward like the wheels of a slot machine. Just over 2 minutes into the burn, Lovell reported a speed of nearly 20,000 miles per hour, faster than humans had ever moved. Over the next 3 minutes, the craft would need to exceed 24,000 miles per hour to achieve the desired trajectory. The G-forces continued to increase. In Houston, everyone from Kraft and Charlesworth to the men in the farthest back rooms hardly breathed. With 40 seconds to cut off, Apollo 8 had reached about 98% of its target speed. In Maui, spectators at an observatory watched the exhaust plume billow from the base of the Apollo 8 rocket as the engine burned through its last seconds of life. Inside the spacecraft, the crew heard almost nothing and felt little more than an ever-increasing push, 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 as the craft grew lighter with the burning of propellant. "All right, 15 coming up here," Borman called to his crewmates. "Real fine, 10 seconds, Lovell affirmed. "How's your inertial velocity?" said Anders. "Velocity's looking fine," Lovell replied. The men were now 6 seconds from leaving Earth. 5, Lovell called. 4. The ship was traveling at more than 24,000 miles per hour. If the engine had one last push, it needed to push now. No one moved at mission control. The third stage engine cut off. The astronauts in mission control looked at their instruments. Apollo 8 was 215 miles above Earth and traveling at 24,208 miles per hour. Ideal for translunar injection and a trajectory to the moon. Immediately, Earth answered, using its gravity to pull back on the ship and slow Apollo 8's speed, but not nearly enough to overcome its momentum as it traveled away from the planet. In mission control, Gene Kranz, who'd been a flight director for Apollo 7, got up from his seat, left the room, and broke down in tears at the magnitude of the moment. Standing in the back row in mission control, Chris Kraft watched as the green blip on the screen moved away from Earth. When he'd joined the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics, the precursor agency to NASA, in 1944, rockets were still the stuff of comic book covers and science fiction. Today, only 24 years later, he was watching men venture beyond their world, not on graph paper with theoretical trajectories, but in real time, in the sky above him. He felt the urge to speak, to say something to the astronauts, to announce something profound. But he was an old pro and didn't dare step on the Capcom's role. Rules were essential at a time and a place like this. The Capcom was a fellow astronaut. It was his reassuring, familiar voice the crew should hear during flight. To jump in now would break protocol and might cause confusion. And for that reason alone, Kraft believed it unethical to speak at all. He watched the green blip move for a few more seconds, moving farther and farther from Earth. Still, he needed to speak to someone. So he spoke to the green blip, and the entire room heard him. "You're on your way," Kraft said. "You're really on your way now." Chapter 13. A Deeply Troubled Year. Streaking away from Earth, the astronauts left behind a deeply troubled planet at the end of a deeply troubled year. 1968 had begun on an optimistic note with a medical miracle. At Stanford University in California, Dr. Norman Shumway performed the first successful heart transplant in the United States. A week after the operation, 54-year-old steel worker Mike Kasparak appeared to be doing fine. As America picked up the confetti from its New Year's celebrations, the country's presidential campaigns began in earnest. President Lyndon Johnson, who'd won in a landslide in 1964, looked to be the certain nominee for the Democrats. The early frontrunner for the Republicans was former Vice President Richard Nixon, who'd begun to tour the country and make his case. In Alabama, former Governor George Wallace was preparing a third-party run based on a pro-segregation platform that was popular in the Deep South. Looming over the campaigns was the war in Vietnam. 500,000 American troops were in country. Since 1965, when official combat units arrived, nearly 20,000 American lives had been lost in the fighting against North Vietnamese communist and guerrilla forces. Still, President Johnson and William Westmoreland, the general in charge of U.S. forces in Vietnam, promised the public that the war was going well and that victory was on the horizon. On January 21st, 15 days after the operation, the heart transplant recipient in California died, despite having made it through a fantastic galaxy of complications, according to his surgeon. Just after midnight on the final day of January, tens of thousands of North Vietnamese troops and Viet Cong guerrillas launched a coordinated attack on nearly every major city and town in South Vietnam. The action came as a surprise to American troops who were honoring a two-day ceasefire with the enemy during Tet, the country's sacred holiday. By sunrise, over 120 population centers and military bases had been assailed by more than 80,000 North Vietnamese and Viet Cong fighters, an attack now being called the Tet Offensive. For the first time, Americans were able to watch news coverage of combat without government control of images or information, thanks to reporters and cameramen embedded with the troops. The United States was supposed to be on its way to victory. The president and his generals had sworn to it. And yet here was an enemy that had stormed the American embassy and damaged nearly every stronghold in the South. Night after night, the evening news showed graphic footage from the battle. Often, 90% of the telecast was devoted to the war. One image sank especially deeply into the American psyche. In a still photograph and on film, it showed a North Vietnamese prisoner, hands tied behind his back, being executed by a single pistol shot to the head, delivered from a distance of a few inches by a South Vietnamese national police chief. There had been no charges, no trial, no last words, just the raising of the gun and a single shot to the temple. The photo ran on the front page of nearly every newspaper in America on the first day of February. No one who saw it or watched the film of the shooting on the evening news knew that the prisoner himself had executed in cold blood an entire family. All that America knew was that this terrible war was more ugly and brutal than they'd imagined, and that the clean and quick ending they had been promised seemed very far away. In Orangeburg, South Carolina, a bowling alley remained one of the few local businesses to refuse service to black patrons, despite civil rights laws prohibiting such discrimination. In early February, black students at South Carolina State University began to protest, first by sitting at the lunch counter at the bowling alley, then by gathering in larger numbers and demonstrating outside. On February 8th, a melee broke out during a student rally on the SCSU campus. Panicked police fired into the crowd. The gunfire lasted just 10 seconds or so, but when it was over, at least 30 people had been shot, and 3 black teenagers died. One of them, Delano Middleton, was a high school student whose mother worked on campus. At the hospital, Delano told her, "You've been a good mama, but I'm going to leave you now." The next day, Governor Robert McNair called the episode one of the saddest days in the history of South Carolina, but he blamed the violence on black power advocates. At a time when hundreds of Americans were dying every week in Vietnam, the Orangeburg Massacre, as it would be called, soon faded from the headlines. But the future it foretold for 1968 was only just starting to crystallize. During a background briefing 10 days into the Tet Offensive, U.S. Secretary of State Dean Rusk erupted at reporters who were pressing him with tough questions. "Whose side are you on?" Rusk demanded. The press was offended that Rusk would challenge their loyalties, but the reality was that the country was deeply divided about the war. Much of the difference in opinion fell along generational lines. Older people tended to trust the government. Younger people tended to question everything. In fact, by 1968, a common expression among the counterculture was "never trust anyone over 30." And it was around that age that political opinions seemed to divide. Thousands of roadside billboards admonished, "Beautify America, get a haircut." By late February, the Tet Offensive had ended. By all accounts, it was a resounding American military victory, yet that was not the message delivered by Walter Cronkite to the nation during his February 27th newscast. The CBS anchor had traveled to Vietnam during the Tet Offensive to see things for himself. Cronkite rarely offered his opinion. Now he spoke candidly, and viewers hung on every word. To say that we are mired in stalemate seems the only realistic yet unsatisfactory conclusion. It is increasingly clear to this reporter that the only rational way out, then, will be to negotiate, not as victors, but as an honorable people who lived up to their pledge to defend democracy and did the best they could. This is Walter Cronkite. Good night. When President Johnson saw the broadcast, he is said to have told those around him, "If I've lost Cronkite, I've lost the country." On the same day that Cronkite addressed the nation, 25-year-old Frankie Lyman was found dead on the floor of his grandmother's New York City apartment. Lyman had been a teenage singing sensation, part of the doo-wop group The Teenagers, and had been the angelic lead voice on songs like "Why Do Fools Fall in Love," which he'd helped write at age 13. As his boyish voice deepened, he faded from public favor. Depression led to a heroin addiction, but by 1968, he claimed he was clean and hoped America would give him another chance. Police who found his body discovered a needle nearby. When news broke of his passing, people around the country pulled out their old teenagers' records and listened to Frankie ask, "Why do birds sing so gay and lovers await the break of day?" To so many of them, the 1950s sounded like a very long time ago. In 1967, President Johnson had appointed a commission, chaired by Illinois Governor Otto Kerner, to study the race riots that had erupted in several American cities since 1965. On the last day of February 1968, the Kerner Commission issued its report, along with this conclusion: "Our nation is moving toward two societies, one black, one white, separate and unequal." By March 1st, after a month of news about the Tet Offensive, President Johnson's approval ratings had dropped by double digits. Infused with new energy, supporters of peace candidate Eugene McCarthy, a quiet, intellectual senator from Minnesota, campaigned almost nonstop in advance of the New Hampshire primary. Most of them were young and fervently anti-war. Many even cut their hair and put on smart clothes to be clean for Gene. McCarthy was a long-shot candidate, but some thought he might get enough votes to avoid embarrassment. On March 12th, the day of the New Hampshire primary, McCarthy did much better than that. When the results came in, he'd tallied just 410 votes fewer than the president, a stunning near upset. Immediately, New York Senator Robert Kennedy announced that he would enter the race. Overnight, it seemed that an indestructible American president had turned to clay. 19 days after the New Hampshire primary, President Johnson delivered an address to the nation on live television. At the end, he announced, "I shall not seek, and I will not accept, the nomination of my party for another term as your president." Shockwaves rippled through the country. In 9 months, America would have a new president. In April 1968, Martin Luther King Jr. went to Memphis, Tennessee, to support striking garbage workers. He led a march with black laborers who held signs that read, "I am a man." King, as always, intended to demonstrate peacefully, but the march turned violent. A black teenager was killed and 60 protesters were injured. King himself had to be whisked away to safety. Days later, he told a crowd at the city's Mason Temple Church, "Something is happening in Memphis. Something is happening in our world." He spoke of justice and fair treatment for the sanitation employees, of nonviolence, of the power of collective action. And he offered these parting words: "Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. but I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will, and He's allowed me to go up to the mountain, and I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we, as a people, will get to the promised land. The next evening, April 4th, at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, King prepared for another rally. As he stood on the balcony outside his second-floor room, he called down to the parking lot to Ben Branch, a musician, and asked him to sing a special song for him at the event that night, an old spiritual, "Take My Hand, Precious Lord," one of King's favorites. A moment later, a bullet tore through King's jaw, severed his necktie, and ripped open his neck. Ralph Abernathy, King's close friend and fellow civil rights leader, rushed to King and cradled him in his arms. Martin, it's going to be all right," Abernathy said. An hour later, King was pronounced dead at St. Joseph's Hospital in Memphis. That night, America started to burn. Riots and violence broke out in 130 cities across the country. Over the next several days, 65,000 Army and National Guard troops were dispatched to try to keep the peace. In Chicago, Mayor Richard Daley ordered his police superintendent to shoot to kill arsonists and shoot to maim or cripple looters. In Washington, D.C., soldiers stood guard on the White House lawn as fires raged just blocks away. On the night King was shot, Robert Kennedy was scheduled to give a speech in Indianapolis. When news of the assassination reached city officials, they warned Kennedy that his safety could not be guaranteed. He went anyway. When he arrived at the corner of 17th and Broadway, he climbed onto the back of a flatbed truck and stood out in the open. Wearing his late brother John's dark overcoat, he spoke to the mostly black crowd without looking at notes. "For those of you who are black and are tempted to be filled with hatred and mistrust of the injustice of such an act against all white people, I would only say that I can also feel in my own heart the same kind of feeling. I had a member of my family killed, but he was killed by a white man." Never before had Kennedy spoken publicly about his brother's assassination. He called for compassion and asked for a prayer for the King family. By the end of a week of rioting throughout the country, 39 people had died, thousands had been injured and arrested, and millions of dollars of property damage had been done. Indianapolis, however, had stayed calm. In mid-April, John Lennon and George Harrison became the last two Beatles to leave India after traveling there in February to study meditation with Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. They'd grown disenchanted with the spiritual leader after hearing he'd made a pass at women who'd joined their pilgrimage. When asked by the Maharishi why he was departing, Lennon said, "Well, if you're so cosmic, you'll know why." Later that month, student activists occupied five buildings at Columbia University, took a dean hostage, and issued a series of demands. Among other things, the students insisted that the university end its association with a military think tank and halt its plan to build a gymnasium in Harlem on the site of a park used by lower-income residents. Columbia officials resisted, only growing more entrenched as the students smashed furniture and shattered windows, destroyed academic research, and hung posters of Vladimir Lenin, Che Guevara, and Malcolm X on the walls. For a week, the university administration tried to wait out the protesters. Finally, they asked police to remove them. At 2:20 a.m. on April 30th, 1,000 officers, many carrying flashlights and billy clubs, stormed the occupied buildings. Some students resisted passively, others by punching, biting, or throwing bottles and batteries. Many police officers used force, some of it brutal, to pull out the protesters and gain control. To some who watched, a class distinction could be seen in the collision of weathered boots with fresh faces, a working-class force smashing into private school privilege. The confrontation lasted past dawn. When it was over, more than 700 people had been arrested and nearly 150 injured, including 12 police. Shocked parents and other citizens looked at the photos of the aftermath and wondered what had become of their country. Down Broadway from Columbia, a new musical was opening. Hair told a story of hippies, the anti-war movement, the counterculture, and the sexual revolution in 1960s America, and it featured drug references and group nudity. The 67-year-old reviewer John Chapman of the Daily News in New York called the show vulgar, perverted, tasteless, cheap, cynical, offensive, and generally lousy, and recommended that everybody connected with it should be washed in strong soap and hung up to dry in the sun. But even octogenarians who saw the musical had a hard time not singing along to the hit songs Hair produced, including Aquarius and Let the Sunshine In. In May, CBS Television aired a special in prime time, Hunger in America, which told of the growing problem of malnutrition in the world's richest country. According to the documentary, there were 10 million hungry people in the United States, a figure that stunned viewers. The filmmakers even showed footage of a dying, malnourished newborn. But perhaps the most memorable moments came in an exchange with a 14-year-old black student named Charles from Hale County, Alabama, who told a doctor he went hungry during the school day because he didn't have 25 cents to pay for lunch. Dr. Wheeler: well, what do you do while the other children are eating? Charles: just sit there. Dr. Wheeler: how do you feel toward the other children who are eating when you don't have anything? Charles: be ashamed. Dr. Wheeler: are you ashamed? Charles: yes, they haunt you. Dr. Wheeler: why are you ashamed? Charles: because I don't have the money. To win the Democratic nomination for president, Robert Kennedy had to win the California primary. A week earlier, he'd lost Oregon to McCarthy and was trailing new entrant Vice President Hubert Humphrey in delegates. For RFK, the Golden State was the crossroads. If he lost there, he'd likely drop out. As the California returns rolled in, it was clear Kennedy would win. Just before midnight, the candidate went to the sweltering ballroom at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles and addressed a packed house of supporters. Looking more boyish than his 42 years, Kennedy spoke of his belief that America could be healed and come together. In closing, he made a V with his raised fingers, which in 1968 stood for both peace and victory. Followed by his entourage and a string of reporters, Kennedy made his way to the hotel's pantry, where he reached out to shake hands with Juan Romero, a 17-year-old busboy who'd delivered food to his room earlier that week. As the two moved close, a man with a pistol lunged forward, pointed the gun just inches from Kennedy, and began firing, hitting the senator once in the head and twice in the right armpit. As Kennedy collapsed, Romero cradled his head to protect it from the cold concrete and tried to comfort the senator, who had been kind to him a few days earlier and had treated him as an equal. Photographers snapped photos of Romero holding Kennedy. The images would become among the most memorable of the 20th century. Pandemonium erupted throughout the hotel. Supporters held their heads, sobbed, and screamed, "No, no, and not again." Police seized the shooter, a 24-year-old Jordanian-American named Sirhan Bishara Sirhan. In his pocket, they found a newspaper story noting Kennedy's support for Israel. Kennedy was rushed to the hospital where he clung to life. In England, the British Broadcasting Corporation told its audience, "We pray for the American people that they may come to their senses." Early the next morning, on June 6th, Kennedy died of his wounds. Across the country, people walked around, dazed. In New York City, WPIX-TV broadcast the image of a single word, shame, and let it run for 2.5 hours. People of all colors and classes and ages gathered spontaneously at railroad tracks to glimpse the train that carried Kennedy's body from New York City to Washington. When it passed, mothers holding babies waved, children saluted. The elderly tried to stand. Black and white Americans chased the train, running on the tracks together, until the last car disappeared. Richard Nixon became the Republican nominee for president on the first ballot at the party's national convention in Miami in early August. His running mate, Maryland Governor Spiro Agnew, had backed the civil rights movement, but now scolded black people and some of their leaders for not disavowing so-called black racists. He and Nixon would run on a campaign of law and order, one aimed at a silent majority and voters shaken by the events of the year. The Democratic National Convention was held in Chicago later in August. As protests erupted around the city, McCarthy seemed unwilling to seize the moment and lead the passionate supporters who'd backed him for so long. In the end, he received just 23% of the votes at the convention, and Johnson's vice president, Hubert Humphrey, who hadn't entered a single primary, became the Democratic nominee, with Senator Edmund Muskie of Maine his running mate. It was a crushing blow to believers in the anti-war movement. In London, the Beatles were set to release a new single, Hey Jude, written by Paul McCartney to reassure John Lennon's son Julian during his parents' divorce. It would include, as its B-side, the John Lennon-penned song Revolution, which questioned the tactics of the year's aggressive political protesters. But when you talk about destruction, don't you know that you can count me out? It had been just 4 years since the Beatles had dressed in matching suits and run from screaming fans in the opening scene of the film A Hard Day's Night. In 1968, they had long hair and flowing beards and were singing about the pain in the world. Even in music, little seemed the same anymore. At the end of the summer, Atlantic City hosted the 1968 Miss America pageant. Outside the venue, at least 100 women protested the event, which they deemed exploitative. Officials had feared that the demonstrators would start fires, as happened so often during protests in 1968, but the women had promised they wouldn't do anything dangerous. Just a symbolic bra burning. When the event began, they tossed false eyelashes and girdles into a garbage can and crowned a sheep Miss America. But from that day forward, the concept of a bra-burning women's liber gained currency in the United States, despite the fact that nothing was ever set ablaze. In October, the Summer Olympic Games were held in Mexico City. Two American sprinters, Tommy Smith and John Carlos, won the gold and bronze medals, respectively, in the 200-meter race. Standing on the podium to receive their medals, each wearing a black glove on one hand, the two Americans bowed their heads and raised a fist in a Black Power salute during the playing of the Star-Spangled Banner, a protest of the inequality of treatment and opportunity for black people in their home country. Immediately, the athletes were suspended from the team and sent home from Mexico City. The silent statement by the two sprinters had a polarizing and powerful effect in the United States. On October 20th, almost 5 years after her husband's death, Jacqueline Kennedy became Jackie O. Everyone seemed to have an opinion, mostly negative, of the surprise wedding between the former First Lady and the Greek shipping magnate Aristotle Onassis, a man 23 years her senior. It was a match far from Camelot. To many, it seemed that Kennedy had traded her quiet dignity and near saintly virtue for a life with a crude, short, cigarette-smoking man who appeared to offer little more than money. And it seemed a break with a more innocent time, one when fairy tale stories still happened in America. As October bled into November, and with America just days away from electing a new leader, Jimi Hendrix's new cover of Bob Dylan's All Along the Watchtower rang out from cars and college campuses in protests, his guitar making a sound no guitar had ever quite made before. A black man singing a white man's song with the opening lyric, "There must be some kind of way out of here." And a reminder, in the midst of one of America's most volatile years, that the hour is getting late. Polling at 15%, independent presidential candidate George Wallace controlled millions of votes, most in the Deep South. At a time when many in the country were offended by what they perceived to be a disregard for decorum and civility, Wallace made no secret of his contempt for the unkempt. "You got some folks out here who know a lot of four-letter words," he said when interrupted by hecklers. "But there are two four-letter words they don't know. W-O-R-K and S-O-A-P. When the election results were tallied, Nixon received 43.4% of the vote, Humphrey 42.7%, and Wallace 13.5%. More than 73 million votes had been cast. Nixon's total exceeded Humphrey's by just 499,704, about the size of the population of Atlanta. For the first time in more than a century, a new president would not have his party control either the Senate or the House of Representatives. As with most everything in 1968, America seemed split in two. In late November, the Beatles released their first double album. Officially titled The Beatles, it quickly came to be known as The White Album for its stark white cover. It was worlds apart from their 1967 album, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Neither the songs nor the sides seemed connected or to flow from one another. Some of the lyrics were overtly political, and each member seemed, more than ever, to be writing solo material rather than as part of a whole. 2 weeks after the White Album's debut, the Rolling Stones released their own classic, Beggar's Banquet. The LP featured the track Sympathy for the Devil, sung by Mick Jagger from the perspective of Lucifer asking, "Who killed the Kennedys?" and answering, "After all, it was you and me." In Street Fighting Man, Jagger, who admired the spirit of revolution during 1968 and had even joined big protests, seemed to lament that the best help he could give was by singing. As America entered the final 2 weeks of the year, a grim statistic emerged from Vietnam. More than 16,000 Americans had died in the war in 1968, by far the bloodiest year to date by a factor of almost 50%. At their offices in New York City, the editors of Time magazine decided on its Man of the Year. Their criteria did not include virtue, only that the selected person be the one who most affected the news and embodied what was important about the year. Previously, the magazine had named luminaries such as John F. Kennedy, Winston Churchill, and Mahatma Gandhi. For 1968, they chose the dissenter. Chapter 14. A Critical Test. Just 8 minutes after the third stage engine cutoff, Apollo 8 burst through the altitude record of 853 miles set by Gemini 11 in 1966. But there was little time to celebrate or even notice the achievement. The spacecraft needed to separate from the spent third stage booster, the S-4B. To make it happen, Borman turned a T-shaped handle that triggered a set of explosives, cutting loose the expired third stage in a spectacle of pyrotechnics. For 5 seconds after the separation, Borman slowly moved his ship away from the expired third stage. Then he did something strange. Using the thrusters, Borman pivoted the spacecraft 180 degrees and began to move back, nose first, toward the cast-off third stage. This maneuver wouldn't benefit Apollo 8, but it would be critical to future missions designed to land on the moon. On those flights, the lunar module, the landing craft that would deliver astronauts to the moon's surface, would be stowed on top of the third stage. Apollo 8 carried a large cylindrical water tank to simulate the mass. To retrieve the lunar module, the crew would need to return to it, pull it free from the third stage, and carry it to the moon. Borman needed to prove that the maneuver would work. He couldn't dock, of course, but just needed to get close enough to confirm the procedure. Now, pointed back toward the third stage, the astronauts were awed by the view of Earth. Out the spacecraft's windows, the planet was a round swirl of vibrant blues and whites, with much of its curvature visible. Lovell grabbed a 70mm Hasselblad camera mated to an 80mm lens and began firing away, flying through a magazine of color film, capturing Cuba and Jamaica at the planet's bottom, never worrying about framing or filters lest he lose perspective. Moments later, Lovell turned his camera to the still-glowing third stage. Hundreds of shimmering stars appeared to fill the sky, but the crew knew these to be fuel particles coming from the tanks or flakes of ice from the tank walls. In Hawaii, observers could see a speckled white fog in the sky as liquid hydrogen vented into the pre-dawn dark. At the speed Apollo 8 was traveling, more than 20,000 miles per hour, Earth appeared to shrink before Lovell's eyes, growing smaller with each passing second in the way a tunnel entrance appears to shrink to a passenger looking out a car's rear window. "We see the Earth now, almost as a disk," Borman radioed to Houston. "We have a beautiful view of Florida now," Lovell added. "We can see the Cape, just the point, and at the same time, we can see Africa. West Africa is beautiful. I can also see Gibraltar at the same time I'm looking at Florida." Even Borman, who'd warned Anders not to spend time sightseeing, couldn't avert his gaze. "This must be what God sees," he thought. Now it was time to move away from the third stage, which had the same 20,000-mile-per-hour velocity as Apollo 8, and was following the ship into space. A wayward cylinder as tall as a 6-story building and 22 feet longer than the remaining spacecraft the astronauts were riding. Unlike the Saturn V's first two stages, which had fallen back to Earth by force of the planet's gravity, the third stage, like the spacecraft, had too much momentum for such a fate and continued to move along with Apollo 8 toward the moon. If all went according to plan, Apollo 8 would pass just ahead of the moon, while the third stage would pass its trailing hemisphere, then slingshot into orbit around the sun. But not all was going according to plan. The crew of Apollo 8 had lost sight of the third stage, yet Borman knew it to be just 100 or 200 yards away, a mere whisker in infinite space. And that meant trouble. If the crew couldn't see the third stage, they couldn't be certain they wouldn't collide with it. For all the engineering miracles of the Apollo spacecraft, it hadn't been designed to absorb a ramming by an entire stage of a Saturn V rocket. The loss of visual contact came as a surprise to Borman. The crew hadn't trained for that. Anders could see that his commander believed an emergency to be unfolding. Borman fired his thrusters, and Apollo 8 gained 1.5 feet per second in velocity, about 1 mile per hour. He could only hope the direction of the spacecraft's movement was away from the third stage, but he couldn't be sure because he still couldn't see it. For several moments, the crew could only sit there and wait for a possible impact. Then, as if by magic, the third stage drifted back into view, just a little farther away than before. Already, Apollo 8's evasive maneuver had altered its trajectory to the moon. That could be corrected along the way, But the third stage still stayed with Apollo 8 like an old dog following its master. Borman estimated it to be just 500 or 1,000 feet away, much too close for comfort. Borman could have fired his thrusters again, but in space that had to be done in the correct direction, a difficult task to perform manually and by sight. If Borman added velocity in the wrong part of the spectrum of angles, he might only increase the spacecraft's vertical separation from the third stage rather than get ahead of it. Or he might even move Apollo 8 back into the third stage's path. That was one of the challenges of flying in formation in space. You had to know not just your own trajectory, but that of the object you were trying to move toward or away from. And there was little about orbital mechanics that one could eyeball against a black background that stretched forever. The spent stage moved even closer to the spacecraft. From Houston, Collins recommended a separation maneuver. "I don't want to do that," Borman answered. "I'll lose sight of the S-4B. "Frank, if you use zero, then make the separation, if possible, in the plus X thrusters. That's the direction of the burn we'd like," Collins said. "Well, can't do that. I'll thrust right square into that S-4B, Borman argued. For the next several minutes, Collins and controllers in Houston wrestled to determine a separation maneuver that would move Apollo 8 safely away from the third stage without causing Borman to lose sight of the threat. Making matters more difficult, the third stage continued to vent propellant, creating a virtual snowstorm in the jet-black sky. Earth was nowhere to be seen through the spacecraft's windows. Apollo 8 needed a landmark, some reference point against which to maneuver, but there was none in any direction. Finally, Houston devised a burn maneuver it believed could move Apollo 8 to safety. Borman didn't seem entirely comfortable with it, but he performed it using the spacecraft's thrusters, then waited to see where it took his ship. "How is that booster looking now?" Collins called. "Is it drifting away rapidly, or how does it look?" "We're well clear of the S-4B now, Houston," Borman said. While the astronauts had been focused on navigating away from the discarded third stage, Apollo 8 had passed through the Van Allen belts, two massive donut-shaped bands of intense radiation that encircle Earth. Named for James Van Allen, the American space scientist who discovered them in the late 1950s, the belts had long been thought to pose a danger, even a deadly one, to space travelers. For years, scientists and government agencies had tried to figure out a safe way through the belts. Van Allen himself suggested that detonating a nuclear bomb might clear the radioactive particles enough to allow spaceship passage. In the end, NASA determined that the Apollo spacecraft would be traveling so fast and the astronauts would be so well shielded by the command module that the risk of harmful radiation exposure would be minimal. But no one knew for sure. To test it, NASA had fitted each member of the Apollo 8 crew with a personal radiation dosimeter, an ivory-colored device about the size and shape of a bar of soap that Anders had helped to design. It would measure the levels of radiation to which the astronauts had been exposed. The device had a tiny 5-digit analog meter to provide readings. Now that Apollo 8 had passed through both belts, the first of which extended from about 600 to 3,500 miles above Earth, the second from about 9,300 to 14,000 miles above Earth, Collins wanted a radiation reading from the crew. Borman was eager to learn the results. He'd heard the dire warnings some scientists had made about passage through the belts. Anders, a nuclear engineer who had developed expertise in shielding against charged space particles, felt certain no damage had been done. It was he who radioed back to mission control with the results. "Houston, Apollo 8 with a PRD reading." "Go ahead," Collins responded. Anders gave the verdict. After passing through both belts, none of the astronauts had received more than about one-tenth the radiation of an average chest X-ray. The command module was even better than a lead bib in protecting human beings from high-energy particles. The spacecraft was now about 22,000 miles from home. Out the window, Earth had grown even smaller. The entire planet now fit in Lovell's center window. "Good grief," Collins radioed. "That must be quite a view." "Yes," Anders said. "Tell the people in Tierra del Fuego to put on their raincoats. Looks like a storm is out there." Apollo 8 was now 5 hours into its journey. In the 2 hours since it had left its parking orbit around Earth, its speed had decreased from more than 24,000 miles per hour to just 9,450 miles per hour as Earth's gravity continued to act on the unpropelled spacecraft. That decrease in speed would continue until Apollo 8 was about 5/6 of the way to the moon, when lunar gravity would dominate and begin pulling the spacecraft toward its surface, causing the speed to rise again as the astronauts fell toward their target. But even at these decreasing speeds, Earth continued to appear smaller every time the crew looked back. To Anders, it felt like watching the clock in fifth grade. If you stared, it didn't seem to move. But if you looked away and then looked back a short time later, it had changed. If Apollo 8 were allowed to fly freely now without any mid-course corrections to its trajectory, it would coast for about 3 days, then smash into the moon. Mid-course adjustments would be necessary, as many as 4 if needed, but those would come later. Around 6.5 hours into the flight, the first shift change occurred at Mission Control, when the Maroon team, led by Flight Director Milt Windler and Capcom Ken Mattingly, took over from the Green team. They would run the flight for the next 8 hours until their replacements, the Black team, took over. After that, it would be back to the Green team, and so on. 30 minutes later, Apollo 8 prepared for another of its critical maneuvers. Until now, the spacecraft had flown with one of its sides exposed to the sun and the other side facing away, but that arrangement couldn't last much longer without damaging the ship by broiling one side and freezing the other. To solve the problem, NASA had developed a procedure called passive thermal control, in which the commander slowly rotated the ship on its long axis, making one full revolution every hour as the craft journeyed through space. In that way, temperatures would become evenly distributed as the spacecraft turned on its invisible rotisserie spit. The maneuver had earned the nickname barbecue mode at NASA, and as Borman tapped a thruster, Apollo 8 became the first to use it in space. So slow was the roll that the crew hardly sensed it. Now, as they continued to streak toward the moon, the astronauts prepared for emancipation. More than 8 hours and 45,000 miles into their mission, the time had come for the men to slip out of their bulky spacesuits. They had been wearing them since long before launch in order to breathe pure oxygen. Doing so helped to purge nitrogen from their bodies, and that had been critical during launch. As expected, the cabin's internal air pressure dropped rapidly as the spacecraft ascended. If the crew had not purged the nitrogen from their systems, the sudden drop in pressure could have caused the nitrogen to form bubbles in their tissues that could press on nerves, lungs, spine, even the brain. A painful and potentially deadly condition, common to deep water scuba divers who surface too quickly, and known as the bends. Once in space, the astronauts had been so busy with equipment checks and the translunar injection burn that they hadn't had a chance to remove the suits. Until now. The crew doffed their suits and stowed them in bags under their seats, where they would remain for the duration of the flight. Suddenly, unbound, Anders was free to test his new superpower. Weightlessness. A breath of a touch, just enough to light an elevator button, propelled him to any destination inside the cabin. If there were twists and turns in his way, he simply bent or hunched or corkscrewed to conform to the openings, flowing through them like water. Using his fingertips for thrusters, Anders visited navigation instruments, storage areas, labyrinths of valves. His lightweight coveralls, made of fire-resistant Teflon beta cloth, were perfectly white, except for a large American flag patch sewn onto the right shoulder, the Lovell-designed figure-eight mission patch on his left shoulder, and a red and blue NASA patch on his right breast. They made for a perfect flying skin, cinched at the waist and tight enough to keep his body slender. Like electricity moving through a circuit board, Anders made turns and changed directions with precision. Sometimes he looked like a giant strand of spaghetti being slurped through the cabin, yet he managed never to bang into anything or catch any of his coveralls' pocket pouches on equipment. When he stopped moving, he put objects into twirling, spinning, tumbling motion. A penlight, his camera, even the chewing gum in his mouth all came to life in a floating symphony that Anders conducted. Soon he got into the act himself, doing a somersault, then another. As he got ready for a third, he thought, "Whoa, what's that hairy feeling coming up in my throat?" And he knew, if he flipped again, he would vomit. Slowly, he floated back to his seat, strapped himself in, and stared at the instrument panel, trying to orient himself in a world that had suddenly lost its up and down. Although the ship still flew backward, blunt end toward the moon, the crew constantly had new views out their windows, courtesy of barbecue mode. By now, Earth looked to be the size of a softball. Its beauty made Anders forget his roiling stomach. He could pick out the distinctive shape and deep blue waters of the tongue of the ocean in the Bahamas, and the iridescent turquoise of the shallow waters that framed it. He could see the Horn of Africa in its sun-baked salmons and browns. But sometimes there were so many clouds it was hard to distinguish what was what. The nun, who'd taught Anders' first-grade class, had kept a globe on her desk, and it had the North Pole at the top. That's how every globe Anders ever saw had looked, with the world positioned logically, north on top. And that's how he sought to make order of things out the spacecraft window, yet sometimes the views made no sense. Things weren't where they were supposed to be. Shapes didn't belong. And what was that giant white spot on the top of the planet? For several moments, Anders couldn't place it. Then it hit him. Antarctica. The continent that was supposed to be at the bottom of the globe. Even now, he had to remind himself that there was no up or down in space, or even in the universe. It had always been a matter of perspective, and now he had to change his. Turning himself upside down, he now understood Antarctica, the hemispheres, and the shape of a world he'd seen only one way. Until now. While the astronauts continued to move through their checklists and monitor the spacecraft and its systems, they also had to tend to personal systems. Going to the bathroom was a challenge, largely because the command module had no dedicated facilities. Urinating was a straightforward, if inelegant, process. It began with a kind of open-ended condom for which the astronauts had been fitted during training. The devices came in small, medium, and large sizes, but astronauts assigned a more scientific nomenclature to the fittings. Extra-large, immense, and unbelievable. Once out of his suit, the crewman would slip on the condom, then belly up to a valve, and attach the other end to a bypass valve that, once it was opened, vented out the side of the spacecraft. If the procedure was timed properly, the astronaut could open the valve while urinating and expel the waste into space. If it was not timed properly, he risked exposing his tender parts to vacuum forces. To prevent that, Anders opened the valve too slowly on his first attempt, blowing off the personal end of his condom and sending twinkling golden droplets dancing weightless through the cabin. His timing improved after that. He made sure of it. Even when urine was expelled properly from the spacecraft, the crew couldn't quite be done worrying about it. Just the tiny force necessary to vent the liquid, which turned to gleaming ice crystals.